Let me introduce our panelists to you, who are a fantastic set of panelists who, for this discussion, chosen specifically for this discussion because of the roles and the expertise that they have, that they can bring to the discussion. First of all, we have Sir Suma Chakrabarty, the chair of the Overseas Development Board of Overseas Development Institute's Board of Trustees and former president of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. He held that position for 8 years between 2012 and 2020. Previously, he was the permanent secretary at the UK's, at the time, Department for International Development, and also worked at the Ministry of Justice, the Treasury as well in the UK government. And previously worked on in international development, including in Botswana in the early 1980s. So thank you, Sir Chakrabarty. Thank you for joining us, and we're looking forward to your insights for this discussion. Next, I have Director Mama Keita. She's director of the Office for Eastern Africa of the UN Economic Commission for Africa. She's based in Kigali, Rwanda, and has also a very long career in the field of development economics. Previously worked as the economic advisor to the Prime Minister of Guinea, held positions as an economist in the World Bank, and is also a doctorate with a PhD in economics and also statistics. So we're very pleased that you're here to join us, and in particular also help us understand the work that the UN Economic Commission for Africa has been doing in this area, which is really important for our audience to know and understand. Thank you. And last but not least, I will introduce you to Paulo Gomes, the co-founder of New African Capital Partners. He's a global business leader, active environmentalist as well, acute knowledge of the politics and policies of Africa. He's been supporting an advisor to several governments and also worked as executive director of the World Bank. He has founded his several firms, advises governments and businesses on strategic investments in the continent, and also serves on several boards of firms and also banks on the continent, and also serves currently on the board of the African Union's Special COVID-19 Response Fund, which, very happy to have you here, Paulo. You have your fingers on the pulse, as it were, on these issues. He also just shared with me that he's had maybe around 30 plus COVID-19 tests recently, which I think having to travel is not an easy thing to do at this time. So we also rely on him for understanding how the current landscape of COVID-19 is across Africa right now. Thank you so much for joining us and taking the time to be part of this discussion. So why are we here? What is this discussion going to be about? Well, first of all, let me put a question to the audience, which I think will help situate what this discussion is about. And again, I think help our panelists also understand what the audience are thinking about these issues at the moment. Could we have the first poll? Audience, the question to you is, how much do you know about the idea of a liquidity and sustainability facility and or other ways for African countries to pool finance or their collateral in order to get more financing? So you have three options there, either nothing and you're looking forward to learning, you know just a little but you want to know more, or third option, you know a lot and you're also looking forward to sharing your views, and I hope you will do in the Q&A if you're in that category. We'll give the audience just a few more seconds to vote. Let us know what they're thinking about these issues. Can Africa pool together? few more votes to come in, I think, one or two. Okay, I think we can close the poll now. So we have 50% of the audience say they don't know anything about this topic and are looking forward to learning more. And then we also have the other 50% saying they know a little but want to know more. So I think that helps you panelists in terms of knowing where to pitch your discussions and explain these key concepts in terms of financing. So let's begin, shall we? Director Cater, can I come to you first? What is the reason for African countries to come together and pool their financial resources in some shape or the other at this point in time with regards to COVID-19 in particular?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Anna. Good afternoon to everyone. Good afternoon to my co-panelists, if they are in my region, otherwise good morning. You know, African countries are facing several challenges. There are several issues at stake. What is at stake is health security, is economic security, is preserving lives, preserving livelihoods, and preserving the progress that have been made in the past years in Africa, which have not been easy to accomplish actually. And to cater to the all the countries created by the COVID crisis, African countries had, for instance, to suspend the collection of tax from their corporations. They had to face limited domestic resource mobilization, and yet they had to face increased expenditure, notably health expenditure, but also support the private sector and also their consumers to continue to live and to grow and to preserve the jobs. So in this condition, they're facing increasing debt level, threatening debt sustainability, threatening the solvency. They are facing liquidity crisis right now. And then they're facing the same challenges. So the need is arising to come together and to coordinate what they are doing and also to see the options that are available to them. They also are facing the constraint of the high cost of credit in the financial market, and also the risk of seeing the credit rating scores being downgraded, which will complicate also in the future the access to capital market. So the need is there, and they thought that it is important to coordinate their action and think of a collective way of facing the crisis. So, I mean, they have been coordinating their action in several ways. First example would be to access, when the crisis first started, to access the treatment and those test kits, protection kits and things like that. It was not easy to a single African country to access those products, medical and pharmaceutical products, for the single reason that the suppliers on the international market will not provide to small orders. So they had to come together anyway to coordinate their needs and to do pool procurement to access those medical and pharmaceutical things that they needed to protect their lives in their countries. Similarly, access to vaccine is not easy also, and they come also together. And in the same vein also, I think that it's good also to come together to look at what they can do to have access to more finance. They need to send in one voice the needs and their challenges for multilateral institutional institutions to understand it, for capital market managers also to understand those needs. So this is the reason to, let's say, come in a club and express the need for external finance, if I can put it this way.
Great, thank you, Dr. Cater, for explaining that to us. And you know, I think there was just this week, in fact, there's been a discussion of the African finance ministers, and these ideas are clearly several ideas for how to address the financing liquidity challenges but also beyond that are being discussed. So we'll come back to that. But I want to ask, I want to move to Sir Chakrabarty and ask, you know, this is not a unique situation in terms of financing and needing to finance a whole region. You were president of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, and obviously that is, in some sense, a pooling mechanism for Europe. What did member states get out of that, of clubbing together through an instrument like EBRD? And is that something which might be interesting for African countries to look at?
Well, thanks very much, Hannah. And please do call me Suma. And greetings to Mama and Paolo as well, and also to the audience as well. EBRD was created actually exactly 30 years ago. It opened its doors for business. It stands for European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. But the European word is actually sometimes a bit misleading. It's got a global shareholding. In fact, the US is the largest shareholder, all the G7 are shareholders, and increasingly large members of the G20 are now shareholders. So during my time, it was very good to bring in both China and India as shareholders as well. And it, of course, its original purpose was to help the former communist countries of Central and Eastern Europe, former Soviet Union, a move towards market economy. So it's actually somewhat different from the other multilaterals in that it had a and has a somewhat ideological viewpoint about markets being superior to state-led economies. It over time, it was very much quite seen as very successful in terms of the projects that it implemented to help move these economies in the right direction. And it then expanded its business with the support of shareholders to, of course, within Central Asia, to Mongolia first. But Mongolia was, of course, a former communist country, so it could be said to be similar to the other ones. But then the big breakthrough, I think, when they realized the business model worked in countries that were never communist in the first place. It was about private sector development. So expansion to Turkey, and then to the Middle East after the Arab Spring, and more recently, actually, to help out Greece and Cyprus after the financial crisis, showed that the business model worked in many different ways. And as I was leaving the bank, I put forward an initiative about a couple of years ago that the bank should expand further for private sector development, municipal level development in sub-Saharan Africa. We actually had a lot of support from African countries, and I think will become the new strategy within a year or two. So why this success? Well, I think a hell of a lot of this, in my view, depended on firstly, the ideological momentum in the early 90s, which meant that there was a synergy between the major non-recipient shareholders, like the G7, with the countries that were trying to emerge out of the communist economic mess that they were in. So there was a shared set of objectives, which meant that smaller states were getting strong support from the larger members of the club, if you like. That was very, very important. And over time, I guess that's become more difficult, and we should be honest about this, partly because in some countries within Europe, in Eastern Europe you can think of as well, but also in some other countries, there's been more of a challenge to that model of development as to whether it's the right model of development, or at least whether you should have more of a balance between the state and the market going forward. And that debate has also emerged, of course, in the West as well. So you can see these debates going in tandem. And it made, I think, the job of EBRD much harder in terms of, because of its business model was so focused on creating the private sector, harder to be as successful in some places. But EBRD developed as well. It developed a more of a policy making arm as well as just not just a project factory. And that became much more useful to many of these smaller states and the smaller shareholders, we might, the borrowing countries. I think one of the lessons I would take from EBRD is one, a positive one, that about the major shareholders and the smaller members of the club coming together around a project, an ideological project, a real business model that they could share. That made it work. Secondly, in the tougher times, the EBRD management quite explicitly, frankly, during my time, siding with the smaller shareholders and helping them in debates with the bigger shareholders to try and equalize the voice within the institution. And I think that's a big challenge for management of clubs as to who they're speaking for. And particularly if the leadership tends to be coming from the non-recipient countries as well. And I think I would say this, Paolo, I hope would agree, because he and I worked together a long time ago. I think it helped having more and more members of the senior management team, not just myself, but others. I was recruiting with people with real experience in the field, in the countries of operations, in the emerging markets, developing countries, and not just from Western Europe and North America. Frankly, that also is very important to make these sort of clubs work well. And I think the case for EBRD now to have its fourth expansion into sub-Saharan Africa is overwhelming, not just because of the gap in sub-Saharan Africa between where we are and where we want to get to in terms of the SDGs, but also because if you look at the plans of African economies, they're mainly now focused much more on growing the private sector and at municipal level. And that is what EBRD does. So its business model has also now come into, you know, in a way coincided with the strategies of many of these countries. And I think it's going to be very exciting to have EBRD. It also, for me, will challenge another assumption for the fourth time, an assumption that in amongst clubs needs challenging, that clubs can only operate in their own lane. So multilaterals traditionally have always been defined by geographical neatness. So the Inter-American Development Bank works in Latin America and the Caribbean. The African Development Bank does Africa. Surely the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development should only do Europe. What business does it have in going anywhere else? But with this fourth expansion, what I'm saying is implicitly is a recognition that it's the business model fit that matters more than geographical neatness, and that MDBs are complements, they're not substitutes. And I think that's quite a breakthrough, and it's important for the development of clubs, whether it's for sub-Saharan Africa or for other regions, to recognize business model really matters in devising the shape of the club.
Yeah, that really makes a great deal of sense. And thanks for sharing that experience and history with us. Because what you're saying in terms of there are so many needs, right? So many opportunities. And perhaps EBRD can play that function in a specific area. And you're right, it doesn't have to be restricted. And the same thing with different types of facilities, they can be focused on a particular need, on a particular issue. What the ECA have been discussing, the Economic Commission for Africa have been discussing, is something which is specifically focused on liquidity. So we will come back to that point as well. But let me also bring in Paolo, because you're constantly, you know, trying to find more finance to provide for different projects across the continent. Do you see a need for African countries to come together for specific needs, either to bring the costs of lending down, or, you know, deal with private sector development? What's your perspective on this, Paolo?
Yes, thank you, Anna, and thank you for putting this panel together. I think Suma has summed up quite well the experience in the last 10 to 20 years about reinforcing this business model at the multilateral level. It's important to flag here that Suma at that time quite play a very strong role. The UK was very supportive about bringing more voice to developing country into the multilateral system. UK, China also were very, very strong. So it was very interesting how, countries with different ideology were both pushing in the same direction with developing country for more voice into the multilateral system. And the issue of voice here was very important to reinforce the business model. It wasn't essentially geographical, as Suma was saying. And in terms of the business model, there was a need for more understanding of the urgency and the challenges in the countries but also about bringing more diversity in processing the deals and the project within the World Bank. So it was important to bring new skills from developing country. And I remember an important episode was to bring, to have more African representative at the board of the World Bank. It was kind of a successful process. I was disappointed a little bit on two or three issues. The success was the fact that it was added a new share in the bank and the IMF to represent Africa. Although my view at that time was that the third chair should have been given to the African Union, so we could have a more kind of neutral policy recommendations within the board of the IMF and the World Bank, rather than giving that voice to the biggest shareholders of Africa, in this case, countries such as Angola and South Africa, who happen to lead this additional African chair in the board. Had we have agreed to bring the African Union, I think the African agenda would have been structured better to be heard within the board of the World Bank and IMF. But to go back to the point in your question about what Africa can do to, I think the AU is still sometimes a frustrating organization, but a good platform to club the African view. It is not always the best platform for implementation of that African view, but in terms of designing it and using its convening power to get the African countries together. And I've witnessed it with the COVID, for example, with the special fund for COVID. We managed to raise something in the region of $70 million, 70 million, to support the CDC and the frontline worker in many African countries and buy PPPs and all equipments. And with the private sector, African private sector, there was also a platform to enable African country to order, to source the equipments and the PPPs via that platform. And I think Stripe Masiwa, among other people, have played a role on that. So it was a very good sense of urgency from the AU. But I think now, with the Continental Free Trade Agreement and the fact that we have 10 years to implement, the next 10 years will be very important. The next 10 years, we need to plug a very strong sense of urgency because of the challenge of employment, the impatience from the youth. We need to deliver in the next 10 years, and we know the gap of financing we need to implement the CFTA in terms of the need for connectivity, for the mobility of people and goods will require a lot of investment. I mean, close to $100 billion a year. So where do you get that money? You have to get it only if you pool African resources and obviously bring also resources outside Africa, but it's important for African themselves to also pitch in very, very strongly. You and I, we know, Anna, that in Africa, you have more or less something like 1 trillion floating every year between the reserves from central banks and also the pension funds, retirement pension fund, public retirement pension fund and private. So all this money, I mean, let me give you example of the reserve, the central bank reserve, all of them are managed outside Africa. And when you see now the yield returns of those funds, you want the best place to spend those money, that money is in Africa. But there's no common understanding on how we can pool those reserves together to do better. Obviously, we're talking about reserves, so you cannot play with reserves. It's not something very liquid in which you can play with it. But there's space to use those reserves as a guarantee for some leveraging those funds to raise other funds in partnership with banks like the European Development Bank and others. So I think there's a time now for innovation, but I think this has to happen through a public and private kind of interaction in finding those innovative instruments to raise more funds to club African. countries together. And also the issue of the rating. I think the rating agency need to be engaged about how they look at Africa. Is it always fair? We are not looking at fairness in a very poetic and utopian way, but you know, sometimes countries are just downgraded because of events that are beyond their own making. If you look at how many African countries have been downgraded with the COVID, you know, is it the way for a rating agency to look at it and the consequences of in borrowing capacity of African countries? So they have to be brought in on board in this process if we decide that the clubbing of our resources or borrowing need to happen.
Thank you, Paolo. And I think that's a great point to move on to also discuss some of these specific ideas which are being circulated and being discussed in different forums, including the AU and also the Economic Commission for Africa as well. You also make a very important point there about the ratings agencies. We actually had one of the webinars was focused on this question of, are the ratings agencies looking at African risk, right? So I definitely encourage you and anybody else who missed that discussion to have a listen. But of course, one of the points of something like a facility or a borrower's club, which goes across a number of countries, is to avoid too much focus on country risk and to actually look at risk in quite a different kind of dimension and look at project risk perhaps or a number of different project risks in a different way. Something which in my experience, Chinese banks do much more with regard to African projects, looking less at the country risk and looking more at the project risk and issues around that. But let me come to Dr. Keita again, because I think, as I was saying, this is a really great point to ask, what are the specific ideas? Perhaps you could explain to us, Dr. Keita, the liquidity and sustainability facility, which is being proposed by the UN Economic Commission for Africa, and other ideas which might be being discussed by African finance ministers, coordinated debt swaps, other types of lending facilities. What is being discussed, and what is realistically going to potentially come off the ground as a result of this urgent need?
Well, thank you very much, Anna. As you rightly said, as we speak now, African ministers are meeting for the annual meeting of Minister of Finance and Economic Development to discuss issues and also solutions. And on the table right now is really a solution to COVID, how to recover, and how to continue to develop. ECA, since the beginning of the COVID crisis, has been advocating for the establishment of what we call liquidity and sustainability facility. In addition to that, also a call for the IMF to issue additional SDRs, special drawing rights, to an amount of 500 billion SDRs, corresponding to something around between 4 and 6 billion US dollars, depending on the level of the exchange rate. And then this is again to attend to the liquidity needs of countries. Countries need to support their economies. Countries need to support their people, their businesses, private sector, and also themselves to strengthen the health system. So they are lacking liquidity. So the issuance of these SDRs at the level of $500 billion would allocate, based on the current mechanism of allocation of the SDR, will allow Africa to get 25 billion, let's say US dollars, stop speaking in terms of SDR. But, and then what ECA is also asking, not only to issue those SDRs, but also to proceed to some reallocation, because 25 billion dollars will definitely not suffice to attend to all the needs of Africa. And also to come now to the liquidity and sustainability facility, the ask is also to ask those advanced countries who will not be using the SDRs because they have other means of financing their economies, I mean, issuing some stimulus, to bring that that amount of resources or money and set up a sort of a market where African countries will come and put their sovereign bonds, and where investors will come and take some of those bonds. And so that will afford African countries liquidity, and it will avoid them at least partially to go to those capital markets where interest rates are really, really high. When you see some advanced countries, the interest rate is less than 1%. For African countries, for several African countries, it goes beyond 10%. So you can imagine what kind of stress that puts on debt sustainability. And so the liquidity facility is really, that is the main objective and also the mechanism. Okay, it will be based firstly on collecting those SDRs and helping to set up a market, a repo, where African bonds will be exchanged and to raise interest in the investors and to then to allow African countries to access really funds at competitive rates comparable to other advanced countries. So this is the spirit of the LSF. Of course, it brings the issue of governance of the tool or the instrument, and I mean this position are taking in that regard. The LSF will have two broad objectives: to attend to the short-term issues, which are liquidity for vaccine and for recovery, but also the term sustainability. How does it come in here? It's also for the tool eventually to become a tool to finance investment, to finance some big issues such as climate change, energy transition. You know that Africa is facing the negative effect of climate change already. With the cyclone Idai and Kenneth in 2019, for instance, if I take the example of Mozambique, the country was hard hit with massive destruction of infrastructure that costed about $2 billion and costed in terms of GDP, 2 percentage points of GDP. So climate change is there. In Rwanda, where I'm sitting, in Kenya also, you have some very, very ravaging effect of climate change. So countries cannot ignore those effects. They need, while they try to build forward better, as we say at ECA, they need to factor that into their development strategy. And this is what also we are saying at ECA. They will need finance for that. And the LSF will also be playing that role to afford African countries money that is needed for those big, big investment. I think Mr. Gomez also mentioned all the requirement to make AFCFTA work. It will take a lot of investment that will come from the private sector, but also from the public sector to set up the right regulatory framework, legislation to remove all those non-tariff barriers to make this this big African market work, because the dismantling the tariffs will not be sufficient for this AFCFTA to really be transformative. So this is basically in a nutshell what the LSF intends to do and how also it is it's going to work.
Brilliant. Thanks for introducing that to us. And you know, it's clear that it has this kind of very short term function in terms of, and especially in the context of, I know in the G20, and there was a discussion around making sure that there was a debt service suspension initiative, and that was obviously the governments G20 were able to help multilateral development banks have provided extra financing, although not necessarily to as fast as many developing countries might like. At the same time, the private sector has not had any coordinated debt service suspension. So the LSF deals specifically with that to some degree, and then also once it's in place, it can also then help to provide financing and cheaper sovereign bonds for other types of investment in Africa. Now, we also have, there are also a number of other proposals out there. Just recently, Raila Odinga, the African Union Infrastructure Envoy, has been talking about the African Union Infrastructure Fund. Previously, my firm, we've talked about creating a microfinance-inspired lending facility, but applying microfinance lending to the country level. There are also coordinated debt swaps, which are also possible to do. How feasible are these different proposals? Should they all be worked on in tandem? Or, you know, are some, we even talked, I think the very first webinar in this series, we also talked about the African Monetary Fund, and the protocols are all there as well for that to be brought into place. How to decide between all of these and what's going to work? Suma, would you like to share anything on that, or Paolo as well?
Sure. I mean, look, I start from the position that all these ideas are very, very useful, actually, and that the system did need a shake-up anyway. I mean, even before COVID hit, if you go back to Addis, what we had hoped for after Addis wasn't materializing in terms of the quantum of finance that's required, and particularly private finance wasn't really coming through in the quantum needed. So, and then COVID made it worse. So it's absolutely correct that we need these ideas to be worked up. But we need to assess them firstly against some sort of principles, if you like, of what's practicable as well in the short time that we have to get some of these ideas off the ground. You know, some of them I think will not run very easily. For example, the idea of having like the Chinese access to Chinese finance that you mentioned, Hannah, this whole idea of using commodity flows as has happened in the past. We know already that most lending countries will not go for that. So pursuing that much longer, I don't think is really worthwhile personally. Secondly, I think one of the things we've learned last year, but we actually learned this before, is that negotiations between borrowers and lenders are not even-handed. Quite honestly, one has far more access to information and ability to process that information and then make judgments than the other side. So even before the pandemic, we knew this, you know, working in Botswana, as I did at the beginning of my career, it was quite obvious then that we had to equalize the negotiation between the government and Botswana, for example, in the diamonds industry, by bringing in technical assistance to help on the government side. And that's been going on for years. And I know last year, I think in one of your papers, you point out Zambia took on Lazards to try and help, and there have been others as well. So I think whichever one of these ideas we end up running with, the system ends up running with, I think some technical assistance to equalize the balance of power in the discussion will be required. I think a third point I'd make is that ideas such as, for example, coordinated debt swaps and so on, and I'm so old now that I can remember the Brady Plan of the 1980s, unlike most people, I suspect. There's a real issue with these ideas of clubbing together for those who don't need to join the club, i.e. those countries that never got themselves into such a debt situation. So the whole moral hazard issue has to be tackled. And so if we're looking for solutions, we not only have to find solutions to those who have a liquidity problem right now, but those who have actually not got a liquidity problem but need development financing. So we have to have a near-term as well as a long-term aspect to the financing ideas as well. I think I do like the Grameen scale-up idea. I think that's quite an interesting idea. And I think there are plenty of very good African institutions that could come up with the right projects. I mean, you know, you've got Mama sitting there, you know, the ECA could come up with the right projects, African Development Bank and others, but there are plenty that could do so. And that I wouldn't worry about. But I would alight on this issue of having to make a decision quite soon about which one of these things we're going to run with. The crisis is here for a bit longer, of course we know that, but if we want the flow of financing to start moving, and this is where I think the African finance minister's meeting is crucial, they need to start making some choices about what, which ones they're going to push ahead with. Beyond that, I would say there is a big agenda which there is a danger in looking at these new ideas, always with new ideas, are great ideas, but there's a danger of forgetting some old ideas which actually the shareholders of multilaterals, for example, have avoided. It was easy for them to see off the idea of debt suspension. That was easy, traditional idea, done it, they can see it off. But there's some things that they've avoided, which I know for borrowing countries, borrowing members of the club, are very important. I mentioned one already about how the system could be more than some of its parts if it was business model based rather than geography based. But here's another one. We know that we have a lot of safeguards in the multilateral system, environmental integrity, tax responsibility, procurement. Each one of these is absolutely, you know, I would die in a ditch for each one of these. But when you put them all together, and then you're on top of that, you have an NGO lobbying group in each of the Western states pushing for these things. So pushing the shareholders very hard on these things. I do sometimes think there has to be an honest conversation about whether they have together, these safeguards have together made MDBs too cautious, actually, and are not lending enough because of that. Another idea, I think, is the whole idea of releasing MDB capacity. MDBs have lent a bit more in the last year, but nowhere near as much as they could do if actually we change some of the policies. So, for example, all the multilateral banks have very excessively conservative capital policies. You know, they're still using nominal capital calculations rather than risk-weighted capital. If for example, EBRD moved to risk-weighted capital for its capital policy, it would release immediately another 2 billion euros of financing per year, immediately, with actually no additional risk whatsoever. But that's not something that the big shareholders are willing to look at because they're worried about protecting their treasury. But I think they're actually overdoing it and they're far too cautious, if anything. I think we could loosen the capital constraints on partner banks. A lot of the multilateral banks lend through the commercial banking system and we could offer capital relief through guarantees and others. This would again give additional firepower to the whole banking system as well. We also need to become much more serious in the multilaterals about mobilizing capital from new investors with new instruments like the AU infrastructure fund, thematic funds like that, but also old instruments like guarantees as well, again, to increase capital firepower, really. And of course, the traditional friend, the old capital increase that we all know about, you know, and IDA replenishments and African Development Fund replenishments, all of those are still very important. But with these other things that I'm suggesting, we could make a huge increase in the firepower available, financial firepower available to multilateral banks very quickly and at no greater risk than they're currently running now. So, I mean, you know, I've been on the record as saying we need an ADIS 2 of some sort, whereby we actually get the shareholders of the international system together to move on this broader set of points. At the same time, I think right now we need the African finance ministers to decide which of these great ideas that are being debated they can move with straight away. So I think there's a short term and a medium longer term agenda. Yeah.
That's great. That's that idea of an ADIS to a kind of a second financing for development conference, you know, really taking these ideas seriously. You know, as Dr. Keita was talking about, we've got such a big discussion happening now with regards to SDRs, special drawing rights, for those of you who haven't been following. But there are these other options that you've put forward, and we do need to have some much more detailed conversations about these and make sure that where they can happen, that they are being put into place and having very clear I think what you've said, Suma, about this issue of what is the balance between risk aversity and a number of, you know, kind of worrying about what the risks of different projects are even, versus the very urgent needs. And these are very urgent needs. You know, digital access now is an urgent need. There's no doubt. It wasn't before COVID-19 necessarily seen as such an urgent need, and suddenly it is. So I think you're absolutely right. We do need to have these much more detailed discussions on these items. Let me see if Paolo's around. I'm not sure if he has a stable connection.
I'm listening to you, but I.
What's your sense of the feasibility of these different proposals, and whether African finance ministers, African heads of state can prioritize between the different ideas that are around?
Can you hear me?
We can.
Yes. Yes, I think Suma, again, has given a map out a couple of good ideas. I think I will put my finger on the one on maximizing the capacity of the multilateral fund. I like expanding the guarantee schemes. I think guarantee schemes that will be well structured can help to unlock the resources that exist in Africa at the domestic level. There are some liquidity existing that you can play with it. So if we provide some additional mechanism to a guarantee mechanism from some of the multilateral, I think this could help unlock the domestic resources in Africa. For sure, I mean, there are so many priority and so many urgencies. I would like to commend the ECA and Vera Songo and his team to have been so persistent to insist on this liquidity facility. I think we are almost at the end of the tunnel now, and this will bring back the IMF to the initial thinking that I think Keynes has pushed in the past about the role of the SDR. And I think this will be a good thing for Africa, not only in terms of providing liquidity, but also the sustainability aspect that we need to plug into this financing. On more thematic fund or instrument, as I say, the AU has been very good to use its convening power to bring people together, but not very good sometimes in implementing that. So the idea of the Africa Fund, for example, I think it's a good one. It will just require making sure that the structuring and the implementation is made in such a way that is not gonna be taken over by some risk of bureaucracy that could appear when you have so many people deciding and the governance that are specific to the AU. But I think with the reform of the AU now, this is the best time to implement such a thematic instrument. I think we have also the opportunity to bring a player such as China into the radar screen. For example, enabling African firms or even joint venture that could happen between African firms and Chinese firms to list in China. I've been kind of advocate that we could find a way for some of the assets or projects to be listed, whether it's in Shanghai or in Shenzhen. I think it's an opportunity to unlock some resources from China to African project. I've witnessed myself some very interesting example in case of Guinea, whereby a Chinese state company has provided equity into a fund, into a project. In this case, was in a hydropower project, and it was an interesting example. And this can help a little bit push away, I think, the narrative of the problem of the Chinese debt. My experience on any debt, whether it's Chinese, European, and others, is that country have to make sure that when they get into any negotiation for funding, that they equip themselves with the proper capability. You know, one is a good law firm, secondly, an investment manager or a financial advisor, and then you engage with any debt provider. That will help you avoid some mistakes, because sometimes it's just mistakes that are not driven by any corruption and others, but just the way of you want to rush into the project. You might make mistakes in terms of the concession, in terms of the rating, the cost of the money that you are getting for the project. So I think if we bring those principles that each country engage proper professionals with them in a negotiation, this will help avoid some of the mistakes that we had in negotiating the debt with some particular players. But everything has been mapped out. The key is how do you implement those in a parallel track? I think Addis too would be a good idea, but I think even within the institution, prior to having such a big forum, we can start moving the things inside because of the urgency of the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also seems that there's going to be some pretty detailed discussions as well at the IMF World Bank Spring meetings coming up. So that will also, to some degree, provide an opportunity to discuss some of these as well. I'm noticing we have a Q&A coming up. It's time to kind of move to that. And we have one question already shared with us from our audience. So please, panelists, feel free, whichever one of you would like to take this one. Not all African countries have the same social or economic challenges. So how will clubbing together satisfy their specific needs? I think that speaks to one of the points that that Sumo was making earlier on, but maybe would any of you like to discuss that?
Let me try something here. They don't have the same challenges for sure. They don't have the same economic structure, but everybody has been hit by COVID right now. So in the short term, they all are facing liquidity challenges and they need to find solution and urgently. They don't find it, it's a matter of death or life. And so this is a common a challenge. This is what is bringing them together. Otherwise, they have been, even now, actually, they are going to the market a bit uncoordinated. But that one is common to them. That is enough to come together to see if they can club for the longer term. But for now, they are really together to find solution to these things. And to come back to what is being discussed at the Conference of Ministers of that is taking place right now. For now, they're exploring really, they are still on, let's say, traditional, options, okay? To extension of DSI to beyond 20 June, recapitalizing the multilateral development banks, also on the debt sustainability framework of the G20, making sure that it is not full of conditionalities, also help countries to have more predictability of financing. When you are in the need, your people are dying, your economy is collapsing, you need to know when, at what time you're getting the money. So this is what we are discussing right now. But I think it would be good because now they see the interest in coming together and discuss together. ECA is playing a role in that. So it's good to come and bring to them additional options, all the new options that you mentioned. I think it is worth trying that and put to them those new options and see how they see it. So let me stop here for now.
Great. Suma, did you want to come in as well?
Yeah, was it Harpo Marx who said that, was it Harpo Marx or Groucho Marx who said he would never join a club that would have him as a member? it's absolutely true, of course, that no two members of any club are exactly the same. The issue, as I think Mama has really highlighted very well, is do they have a common interest, even if their challenges are different? So, if you look at the European Union, for example, that's another club. Clearly the interests of someone in Western Europe are not the same as those in Eastern Europe. And within Eastern Europe, there are differences as well. But they've decided that there's clearly some common interest in acting, at least at the economic level, as a joint force. they get more out of that than they would if they were to do it separately. And of course, that club also, as we all know, rather well too well, including the UK, has strains. So it's very important, actually, in any club to make it work. It's not just the joining part of it, but the feeling that as the club develops, that you all get something out of it still. And that's where I think the European Union is at the moment quite challenged, actually, leaving aside the UK even. So that's why I place quite a lot of stress on how the club is run afterwards. So there'll be this liquidity crisis that we'll get through, and the club will operate well, and probably because they all have a common interest, exactly as Mama says at the moment. But a club that actually is going to make a longer term difference needs to be run on behalf of all its membership, and the members need to feel that. I think the Africa Union, ECA, they all have a really strong role to play in making sure that feeling is maintained beyond the next 1 to 2 years.
It comes back even to what Paolo was saying with the experience at World Bank in terms of representation. And yep. Having you, for example, it's exactly that point.
The EBRD, of course, the European Commission is a member, so it's the one multilateral institution where, a common body is a member as well as a shareholder in its own right. That has, in principle, I actually agree with Paolo, I should say, but if you have that union as a member, and then you also have the member states as a that becomes a problem. So in the EBRD, it is a problem, actually, that we have essentially, I'm going to be very blunt, France and Germany's voice multiplied through the European Commission shareholding as well. So, I think if Paolo's right, if we could have been kept to the African Union and the Anglophone and Francophone seats of the World Bank, that would have made a lot of sense. But then if you also add all the other African states also as shareholders in their own constituencies, then you've got a real problem.
I think you have to combine it as Suma was saying, you have to combine it, because I think in the case of the World Bank, the idea of the AU was that the representative would be appointed based on a selected criteria. Through a competitive process. So you will make sure that the person who will be sitting there is not overloaded with some political consideration, and to make sure that he represents the rest of the continent, with his own ability and capability. So I think that's a way to correct it. And it goes back to what I was saying about the African Union, is that in terms of interest, the visions, 2063 seem to be shared by all the countries. And one will say that's not enough. That's about the vision. It's very, a little bit romantic, the Pan-African thing, but many countries share that vision. What then you have to do as a next stage is that when you start putting those thematic organizations, you make sure that the entity are competitively selected. So you that will help you get that political. So I don't think it's me. But, okay. Hello.
I'm sorry.
Okay. So selecting the best people for those positions will help reduce the risk of the entity be too politically driven and through the bureaucracy of. That we know with this kind of organization.
Right, yes, and all of these organizations or funds, facilities will have to go through all of these questions. That is the issue around feasibility. It's not just about design of the fund. You then also have to look at the reality and questions about representation and management are very, very crucial. We have another question that's come up, an interesting panel that you mentioned, Pan-African phrase. How does this very important conversation feed into bigger ideals of Pan-Africanism? And perhaps, yes, this is a opportunity, financial independence, I guess, in some shape or form. Paolo, what's your thinking on this?
Yeah, I think you need I think your church used to say that before the fact comes the dream. And I think we need the dream. That was the biggest mistake during those excessive liberal times, to get Africa into a process which, you know, there's no space for, I would not say ideology, but discussing the vision. It was all about, you know, we rush for the market. The market knows how to stabilize things and select the best way of doing things. But I think in Africa, you need the dream. And this new generation are showing us that this is what they want. They want to do things with purpose. So the vision 2063, it's important, is there. If you look at it, there's nothing excessively ideological on that. You have Africa wanted to go, to defend its own interests, to do its sustainability in a sustainable way, to make sure that it's the peace and justice follow. So you have those guidelines. And I think that all this resetting of the COVID shows us that those still valid visions. Now you have to find the instrument to implement that. And this is where I believe that those organizations need to be shaken up. And the effort that has been done with the AU reform has been very good. You have to give credit to what President Kagame and others have done to do that. And you have a much more operational African Union, although there's still a lot to do. So I'm from that generation of the Pan-African vision, and I think it's still valid. The framers of the Pan-African agenda were seen as being too ideological, but they were not. They were dreamers. And I think we need to translate some of the dreaming into reality now, with a strong sense of purpose. It showed clearly that we need to pay attention to what people call the economy of life, you know, education, health. At the end of the day, we see how important it is with this COVID crisis. It's just the management that now we have to pay attention and make sure that we have the right people to the right position and a more realistic timeline in deploying our strategy.
Yes, and I think the African Continental Free Trade Area, of course, is part of that project, and very important that it gets moving and successfully as well. It won't be easy, that's for sure. But obviously also other means of supporting, including through financing, are also going to be very crucial so that it does get off the ground. There's no way that you can do these things without finance. Look, I think we're coming to the end of this discussion. If there are any more Q&As, audience, please send them in very quickly. But I'm going to take the chair's prerogative to ask our panelists one last question before we close. And feel free to also kind of say in very short terms or however you want to say it. My last question, if you were to be advising African leaders now, and Dr. Keita, I realize that you're doing this yourself right now. What, in terms of reimagining financing development, you know, using some of these innovative mechanisms, what would you say they should do right now?
Thank you, Anna. As you say, we are advising African countries right now. And what she's saying is really about building resilience, long-term resilience. All these issues of I can access financial markets, I am vulnerable, I am short in liquidity, comes from the structure of their economies. So we're really pushing for diversification, value adds, leveraging on the huge amount of natural resources in the continent to transform them, and to add value to build strong economy. This is what we're saying, we're advocating, we're pushing for industrialization, also take into consideration the threat of climate change, the opportunity of digitization and digitalization, inclusion. This is what I will say. Then this will attenuate in the future all these issues that they are facing now. They are facing it because of the very extremely vulnerability of the economies. And now, to conclude on the AFCFTA, it is a huge opportunity. it makes that a small economy such as Seychelles with 100,000 inhabitants or a big economy like Nigeria to have access to the same size of market. So it is an opportunity for every country, and it can do a lot. It can transform those economies. And then, and we're seeing also the political will. So we will continue to advise and to promote economic diversification and to, and then to be able to rely on internal means. Whatever option are there for financing, both on the external market, on those innovative tools that you've said, we'll continue to explore to see to what extent it is adaptable to African countries. But the longer, we need to look at the longer term now and really to build strong economies. Thank you, and over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Peter. That's great. Suma, what's your view on this?
Well, well, to govern is to choose, and I think they should choose rapidly one or two of these borough club ideas and really now and try and make them a reality as fast as possible. But then to govern is also to think about the longer term. And I think what I would like to see in the spirit of Pan-Africanism that has actually reemerged, I would say, quite strongly in the last couple of years, is to say, sorry, but you, the main shareholders, the largest shareholder of the multilateral system, you need to listen to us a lot more, actually. And if you don't, the problems we are facing here, our development being constrained because of the choices you make as leaders, as the main owners of multilaterals, are only going to multiply and add to your problems. So here are some ideas we, the African leaders, want to put to you, the major shareholders of the multilateral system, to change the multilateral system. Some of the ones I put out, but there are many others as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that will not happen unless African leaders make a collective push on that. Do not expect large Western owners of these multilaterals to sit there and say, oh, yeah, we should do that. That's not going to happen. They need to be really, really advocated by African leadership in the multilateral system.
Great, great steer there. 100% agree with you as well. Paolo, you have the last word. Oh, let me also mention we have somebody who has suggested that there should be more investment in education so that we have future scientists, economists, health workers, and entrepreneurs. Yes, of course, that's also great advice to African leaders to make sure that investment in education is happening, especially in financial education, so that these ideas can also be taken forward by young people going forwards. Paolo, your advice to African leaders now?
Very quickly, have a strong sense of urgency and ask yourself, why do you need a sense of urgency? And there are two important things that should push you to have a sense of urgency. One is the 20-something million employment you have to create per year in Africa. I think it's much more because they keep changing almost every month. And secondly, the climate change impact is going to have on you, water, agriculture, and an element of stability will affect your stability, your security in the country. And then we have to do things in group. You have to group our energy, our ideas to speak in one voice. When you have a country like mine, we are 1.5 million people. It's only regional integration in Guinea-Bissau that would make us a player. Otherwise, we are just almost a neighborhood, a small neighborhood of Lagos. So I agree with Suma, it has to be in one voice, but we have to change the way we interact diplomatically. We don't, as an African said, don't get into someone else's fight. Don't get into another kingdom fight. So Africa has to make sure that he maintain his interest and not getting into the shocks that's going to happen between the bigs is going to continue. But that will require calibrating our diplomacy. How do we obviously speak in some of those platforms that we know, the multilateral platform. But sometimes, talking to Suma or seducing Suma in one conversation can be an excellent element of diplomacy in seeing where you have to, what are the pressure points to get what we want. So that requires also doing our economic diplomacy in a different way.
Great, thank you, Paolo. Thank you for sharing that vision with us. And I, again, also fully agree with you in terms of the diplomacy. We need to, we do need to do that in a much more strategic and focused manner. Look, thank you all so much. We have one last thing that we're going to do before we close, which is to have a poll of the audience and see if they have been, whether they've changed their views since we began this conversation. So let's have this last poll before we close. In light of our discussion today, audience, do you think African governments should create a liquidity and sustainability facility or another form of borrowers club? You've got three options there. Yes, as soon as possible. The other option is no, getting finance from existing financial institutions is where Africa should focus its efforts, not these ideas. And the last one, maybe, but I don't think it would work or make any difference. Many ideas, many reasons why innovative ideas might not fly for African countries. So you've got three options there. Let's see who says what. Let's see what we've got with our audience. Give a few more seconds to vote.
I'm not able to vote.
Yes, well, panelists, we're not meant to vote.
I vote yes.
We have one a clear view, I think.
One man, one vote, Mama.
Let's wait and see. Almost there. Audience, submit your votes, please. All right, I think we'll close there. All right, we have the verdict. We've got yes as soon as possible. 57% of the audience say make it happen. We've got 29 saying maybe, they're not sure if it will really work. And we only have 14% saying let's just focus on what we've got now and not worry too much. So I think we've made the case for new innovative ideas and thinking, but as Suma says, we need to narrow it down and focus, make it happen. So thank you all for joining. Thank you to our audience for joining us. Thank you for being part of that poll. Thank you so much to our brilliant panelists. All of you brought so many insights to this discussion. I'm really pleased that you're able to join us. And please stay in touch on your work and see, you know, however we can support you in doing that. And last but not least, let me also say thank you to the DR team and our translators who have been behind the scenes making this webinar happen, making it happen very smoothly. So thank you all for your effort on all of that. All right, and tune in to next week. We have a discussion of special drawing rights and what role they can play in dealing with our grey rhinos, as Michelle Wooker would put it, climate change and COVID-19. So please do look out for a registration for that, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.